You discovered Hughes as a teenager. I think many people, like myself, first encountered him from his children's poetry, often anthologised and completely devoid of the personal biography and the kind of drama around it, which has kind of swallowed up his adult writing, hasn't it? How far were you able to disentangle that, and how far is it inevitable that all his poetry now is viewed through the prism of what was going on in his personal life?
I think that is a great difficulty. I mean, he was a writer of extraordinary range. As you say, wonderful children's poetry and indeed prose. I mean, The Iron Man, one of the great children's books, but also radio plays, work for the theatre, work translating Eastern European poets and bringing their work into the public domain, as well as his own poetry. But the main argument of my book is it was precisely the tension between the sort of autobiographical confessional instinct that a writer has on the one hand and the desire to transform experience into something symbolic or mythic or archetypal on the other. For me, that was the sort of creative tension that spread throughout Ted Hughes's career.
What fascinated me about that was you say that Ted Hughes himself acknowledged Plath had achieved that, she was the better poet, and that it then changed his writing after she died.
They made each other as writers. Her work was rather brittle and artificial till she met him. He helped her to write in a much more robust poetic style. His work was all over the place. She organised it and really professionalised him. Then when they separated, which was, I think, very much to do with the feeling that they were stifling each other's work, her work developed quite extraordinarily, and his got stuck and blocked for many, many years. And then, famously, after she took her own life, he discovered this volume of poems, Ariel, and he said, this is the greatest poetry by a woman since Emily Dickinson, perhaps the greatest poetry by a woman ever.
There's a moment in the book where you talk about how and when Sylvia Plath is transformed from this sort of 50s lipstick-loving girl into the oppressed feminist icon. When is that moment and how does it come about?
So in 1971, the absolute sort of height of the feminist movement, you know, people disrupting the Miss World contest and so on, an anthology called Sisterhood is Powerful is published, and it contains all kinds of feminist manifestos. And Sylvia Plath's poem, The Jailer, representing a husband as a kind of demonic, oppressive figure, is republished there.
Segment 1.
You discovered Hughes as a teenager. I think many people, like myself, first encountered him from his children's poetry, often anthologised and completely devoid of the personal biography and the kind of drama around it, which has kind of swallowed up his adult writing, hasn't it? How far were you able to disentangle that, and how far is it inevitable that all his poetry now is viewed through the prism of what was going on in his personal life?
I think that is a great difficulty. I mean, he was a writer of extraordinary range. As you say, wonderful children's poetry and indeed prose. I mean, The Iron Man, one of the great children's books, but also radio plays, work for the theatre, work translating Eastern European poets and bringing their work into the public domain, as well as his own poetry.
Segment 2.
But the main argument of my book is it was precisely the tension between the sort of autobiographical confessional instinct that a writer has on the one hand and the desire to transform experience into something symbolic or mythic or archetypal on the other. For me, that was the sort of creative tension that spread throughout Ted Hughes's career.
What fascinated me about that was you say that Ted Hughes himself acknowledged Plath had achieved that, she was the better poet, and that it then changed his writing after she died.
They made each other as writers. Her work was rather brittle and artificial till she met him. He helped her to write in a much more robust poetic style. His work was all over the place. She organised it and really professionalised him.
Segment 3.
Then when they separated, which was, I think, very much to do with the feeling that they were stifling each other's work, her work developed quite extraordinarily, and his got stuck and blocked for many, many years. And then, famously, after she took her own life, he discovered this volume of poems, Ariel, and He said this is the greatest poetry by a woman since Emily Dickinson, perhaps the greatest poetry by a woman ever.
There's a moment in the book where you talk about how and when Sylvia Plath is transformed from this sort of 50s lipstick-loving girl into the oppressed feminist icon. When is that moment and how does it come about?
Segment 4.
So in 1971, the absolute sort of height of the feminist movement, you know, people disrupting the Miss World contest and so on, an anthology called Sisterhood is Powerful is published, and it contains all kinds of feminist manifestos. And Sylvia Plath's poem, The Jailer, representing a husband as a kind of demonic, oppressive figure, is republished there.